Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo, Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, December 12th, 2011. And I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us in our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and PRN.FM.
And today you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include medical wrongdoing. Should that be a criminal act that's punishable by imprisonment?
And is the patient's welfare affected by nurse burnout?
Mainstream medicine is finally looking for alternatives for peripheral neuropathy. And boy, we've got some great news for you.
And what's more important, fitness or body weight?
And we're going to look at omega-3 fish oils that reduce heart attacks and strokes in young women as well.
And how long does a C. difficile acquired hospital infection lengthen your hospital stay? And much more.
And if you want to join us in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. The lines are open.
So here's some good news for people who are physically active but can't seem to lose weight. You can worry less about your weight as long as you continue to maintain or increase your fitness levels, because a new study shows that your fitness level, even if your body weight hasn't changed or increased, can reduce your risk of death from heart disease, stroke, or any cause.
You know, Vicky, there is no medicine on the planet that comes anywhere near, doesn't do 5% of what a good exercise program does. It does so much to balance our physical selves in a way where we can do more. We have less depression, we have less hypertension, there's less heart disease, we feel good, we can get in better shape and do more physical exercise. It's really important to do fitness. And if you're overweight, so what? You can still get fit. And that's what this is about today, is to remind you that fitness is important, especially if your body weight's high.
And if it sort of makes sense if you really think about it, because it's getting your circulation flowing, so that it's not sluggish, as if, you know, somebody that's sitting on a couch that we call a couch potato that's sedentary. I mean, what happens to their blood flow and circulation?
Well, that's right. But even in the couch potato, 1 hour a week of exercise changes their longevity, and it changes their quality of life. You're better off to be fit and fat than thin and unfit. And that may surprise a lot of people weight conscious.
I've seen thin people that can actually be a little jiggly,
because
they don't have the muscle tone.
That's right. So, I mean, if you don't have a lot of muscle because you're not exercising much, a lot of people with a normal weight have too much fat.
And then there's the elderly, you know, they get so that they're really thin and they have no muscle tone at all underneath their skin, you know.
Well, as you get older, it becomes ever so much more critical to make sure that your exercise level is good, because I can tell you that as you get over age 40, it's a downhill thing for your body. And every decade that you increase in age, it's going to be that much more difficult for you to be able to stay fit and to maintain that fitness. It may take only 6 weeks or so when you're in your 20s to get fairly fit. In your 40s, it may take a couple of months. In your 60s, it may take 6 months. I mean, it's very hard to maintain as you get older. So it's important to stay fit. And if you do, that'll give your body a lot of advantages.
Well, it has a lot more benefits than just helping you to live longer and for your heart and to prevent strokes, because it's also good for depression. It's good for our bones. It's just good for everything, all of our organs, everything.
You know, these people that did this study said that for every MET, which is just a unit of energy that's spent on a particular task, for every MET increase after a six-year study, it resulted in a 19% reduction in heart attack and stroke and a 15% reduction in all-cause mortality. So we're looking here at big changes that you're in control of, that you can do a lot about. So many people depend on medications to solve their problems when their health goes wrong, and they think that there's going to be some magic bullet out there somewhere that's going to do exactly what I need for my problem. But I'll be darned if I'm going to eat healthy, if I'm going to exercise regularly, and reduce my stress levels.
So, hep, two, three,
that's
four,
right.
Let's get up and out the door.
That's exactly right.
Go do your exercise.
Right. And the intensity of exercise is important, too. If you just kind of lollipop around and you're, you know, walking a mile or two a day, that's good. You know, that we give you credit for that. But if you do running for that period of time, pretty much as fast as you can, that's really good.
For the whole time?
If you can, yeah. Well, a lot of people can run.
Well, sometimes there's interval training where people do it for a short amount of time.
That's even better, Vicki, and that's what I was just getting to. If you do interval training, that means that you jog for a while, and then you run as fast as you can for 15 to, say, 60 seconds, depending on how well-conditioned you are. And the better conditioned you are, the longer you'll be able to do that. And that gets you maximum capacity for body effort.
You probably should ask your doctor first, though, before you do that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, all these things, I mean, particularly if you've had a heart attack or you've got some other kind of vascular problem, you don't want to just go out there like a bull at a gate because you've heard us talk about exercise being a good thing. You've got to be sure that it's a safe thing to do, too. So check with your doctors if there's any doubt. I mean, if you're under age 45 or so and you don't have any health problems, you could work into it. You know, but don't be a weekend warrior. Don't go out there and just do the exercise full blast so that it puts you out with an injury for 6 to 8 weeks. A lot of people in their 30s and 40s who aren't used to exercising think they can go back and do what they could in their 20s.
Yeah, I remember somebody that did that once.
Indeed. Boy, that I learned a good lesson. I couldn't walk for a week.
Actually,
but then I was pretty young at the time, too. I was in my 30s.
I also remember when I was a little girl that my dad did that. He was in a race, and he used to be a runner when he was young.
Yeah,
and
sure.
He got into this relay race, and he pulled a big muscle. So, anyway, everything with moderation.
For sure. All right. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So when companies do wrong in the medical industry, the FDA seems to be letting them off. I mean, we need to think about this. You know, is medical wrongdoing a criminal act? Here's another article about how a legal doctrine holds corporate officers liable for corporate wrongdoing by imprisonment, and they only get probation.
Yeah. Well, see, there's an unwritten convention where we don't put corporations in jail if they do something that's a medical wrongdoing. So if Big Pharma comes out with a drug that they know is going to cause a problem. I mean, it's obviously immoral. It's unreasonable.
It's
despicable. It's everything that you can think of as bad. But nobody goes to jail. Nobody has any serious consequences from it. I mean, the company may
have to pay some money, but they make more money than they have to spend on the fine. So it's kind of like worth it for them to do it.
Well, look at the Vioxx story. I mean,
yeah.
There's a drug that was taken off the market in 2004, okay, 7 years ago. In 1995, the drug company knew that this drug was going to cause heart attacks and strokes, but they withheld that information in 1999 from the FDA when it was brought onto the market. Now, we know that's true because we got the information as part of the Freedom of Information Act as the company was being prosecuted for bringing the drug out when they knew they shouldn't. And as a consequence, between 1999 and 2004, about 50,000 people died because of heart attacks and strokes that the company knew was going to be a problem. They may not have known the exact number, but they knew it was a problem. Now, to me, that's murder because they knew exactly what they were doing, and this is a business. And because they thought they were on safe turf, because of the way the convention is to not uphold the law and punish these people with serious crime, they only fined them. Now, the amount sounds outrageous. It was almost $6 billion of a fine, but they made something like $20 billion. So this was a good business investment, and what they do, they got their hands slapped. That's all.
And not enough to prevent them from possibly doing something like this again if they didn't get put in jail because they made out like bandits.
It happens all the time, and I'm wondering, where's the community? You know, where's the compassion? The drug companies are supposed to be making drugs that we can use that are going to help people, not kill them. You could say the same thing for Celebrex, in my opinion. You could have for Bextra, which was taken off the market. It was much like Vioxx and Celebrex are. And the only reason that Celebrex is on the market, in my opinion, is because of the FDA. The FDA is irresponsible about some things. They allow people who make the drug, okay, who make the drug, to go ahead and be on the final committees that vote to determine whether or not the drug should be on the market.
Yeah, there's so much conflict of
interest. Well, there were 10 people, okay, out of 30 people on a board that was on a committee that was trying to figure out whether or not they were going to leave this drug, Celebrex, on the market. And those 10 people obviously voted to keep the drug on the market. All 10 of them did. And they were directly involved with the company at some point in time. So what you're looking at is a shift in what would have happened because of those 10 votes. Celebrex is still on the market.
Okay, this goes for lots of drugs. This also, to me, goes for lots of other things. Like, for example, last week, I think it was, we were talking about how doctors and nurses aren't washing their hands when they're entering and exiting patients' rooms.
Exactly.
And what about hospital infections, hospital-acquired infections?
Well, that relates directly to hand-washing, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, the doctors and the nurses are going from room to room where these infections are. They should be washing every time they do, but they're, quote, too busy, okay, to do that. So when they put a camera up in the patient's rooms and they saw that they were only washing their hands 7% of the time, they told the doctors and nurses, there's a video in there.
And then they started doing it.
It started going up to 88% after a while. Now, to me, that's just outrageous. I mean, here are the people who are trying to save you from having an infection and doing all the good things to help you with your health, and they don't wash their hands. To me, if you got an infection because of that, that's malpractice. In fact, it's malpractice if you don't get an infection, because it shouldn't be done like that. And it should be punishable by a fine and by going to jail. I mean, if there are 100,000 deaths every year, which there are, from these kinds of hospital-acquired infections, we need to be more responsible. The hospitals need to be more responsible. We should be doing things that take care of people rather than things that put them at risk.
Well, you know, it might even spread to food because, you know, hospital food isn't that great of food. It's not really very healthy if you look at it. People complain about it all the time.
Yeah, it's not nourishing. A lot of it's
and
fast
that's
food.
And that's when people really need healthy food is when they're sick.
I'll say. That's exactly right. So I think every time we knowingly do something that's going to compromise the health or life of a patient, that ought to be something that family, if that person dies or is severely damaged from it, should have the right to be able to take the hospital and the doctors and the nurses to court and have it be a felony, because that's just, it would be for anybody else. You know, we go back to the Vioxx story, and we're talking about the other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that are on the market. We've got a new kind of problem here because the FDA knows all this. They know that 30,000 people a year are going to die from non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and they know 300,000 are going to be put in the hospital because of it. And yet they're still on the market. And we don't really get the idea that this is a dangerous thing, and there are other ways to deal with pain besides using drugs that can cause real problems.
And what about the cover-up for the patients that died during surgery because of a bone cement?
Oh, that was another story. You know, three people at least died from it. The research that was done on it was fabricated. It was made up by some of the doctors. And they didn't tell the FDA that, of course, because what they wanted was to get their product on the market. So here we have deaths again. And some people got prison terms from 5 to 9 months. But really, basically, it's like a slap in the hand when people die. You know you've done something wrong, and you're getting a sentence like that. What would happen if you murdered somebody outright with a gun? Would it be
shot three people?
Yeah, I mean, would that be okay? Just a few months in prison and you're out?
Or put that bone cement in their food or something, you know? And
whatever. I mean, just, but we need to be more responsible. And the problem really is what kind of a community do we live in? One where the almighty dollar is the big thing.
We need to have a movie on this kind of thing.
Well, there was one that was called Hospital about 25 years ago that showed a doctor who had a colon cancer in the hospital and how they treated him and how that doctor felt. And stories like that are important to bring forward to show that there's a lot we need to change in what we do.
But I mean, there should be one on the criminality.
Absolutely, there should be. But we should also be teaching our doctors and nurses what it's like to be a patient. You know, a lot of people have no clue. They come in, they do their work, they leave, and it might take 10 minutes to see one patient or 15 minutes to see one patient. And these patients are sick. I mean, they're in the hospital. When you've been in the hospital yourself, you know what happens. You treat it a lot differently. And maybe we'd be thinking more about the medications we prescribe, too, and being sure that we know a lot about it so that we don't have the problem that we're into today where there's all this unreasonable criminal action that's left go. We need to change what we do. The lines are open here on Prescriptions for Health. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, acupuncture eases severe nerve pain associated with cancer treatment. You know, chemotherapy can cause peripheral neuropathy, which can cause excruciating pain or numbness, especially in the calves or the feet. And mainstream medicine so far only treats it with drugs, which are not very effective and can have some terrible side effects. So this is great that they're at least acknowledging that acupuncture can be effective, but I've noticed that they don't mention anything about photon stimulation.
The study wasn't on that. And you have to look at this. It's a rinky-dink study. All they had was 11 patients in the study. Six of them they put in the treatment group and five they put in the control group where they didn't use the acupuncture. And this was using acupuncture for some time. They were talking about using it for several months. There were, I think there were 10 treatments over 3 months. Then they did nerve conduction studies to show that the nerve was damaged. And so what you have here is a small pilot study that makes a suggestion that if you've had chemotherapy and you've gotten neuropathy from it, that you could do some good by doing acupuncture. And I think that's great. And we should bring acupuncturists into the hospital. But no. You go to a hospital and find out and see if any of them will allow you to do acupuncture
in the hospital. I think Kaiser has. Not when you're a patient.
Yeah,
just
see,
as
that's
outpatient,
outpatient stuff. Oh. Another hospital in San Francisco is the same way, where they have this well-known clinic for complementary and alternative medicine. Yet, if you're in the hospital and you need some of those services, sorry, buddy, this is only for doctors.
So it sounds like they're just doing that as like a kudo, just to make people think, oh, this is a great medical center because they offer alternatives, it's just to say that they do, but they don't really practice it in the hospital.
Well, they're trying to appeal to the public and show how open-minded they are, at least for outpatients. But for inpatients, you'd think it'd be even more important. I can remember treating a patient maybe 10, 15 years ago who had two strokes that paralyzed him on both sides of his body. He was 39 years old. He had a problem with a heart valve and wasn't anticoagulated properly, and he was pretty much out of it. And when I took over care on this patient, we tried to bring in things like acupuncture and neurofeedback and Reiki, and knew darn well that if we mentioned it to the staff, it wasn't going to happen. So we just locked the door, and we did the treatments ourselves. And it was about 4 to 6 weeks later, this guy walked out of the hospital. It's unbelievable. And to me, it's absolutely shocking that we don't allow other disciplines access to patients who are really sick. Because if they're really sick and they're not doing that well, look, we need all the help we can get, don't we? We should be able to do the things that might have any value as long as you don't hurt somebody.
I remember when you had your hip surgery the first time, mm-hmm. before you had all your complications, but you had a complication from the spinal anesthetic, mm-hmm. and you had to be transferred to the cardiac care unit. But anyway, one of our healthcare practitioners from the Health Medicine Center came in, and she treated you, and I was wishing that the respiratory therapists could have been there to witness it, and the surgeons and the doctors, in fact, the whole staff, because after she worked on you, you got
better.
But nothing that they did could make you better.
Well, we'll tell more about that story when we come back. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Lynn Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls and finishing up this topic after Vicki presents her first 2020 tip.
Well, we always have to take a minute, you know, for laughter is the best medicine. So it was entertainment night at the Senior Citizen Center, and Claude the hypnotist exclaimed, "I'm here to put you into a trance. I intend to hypnotize each and every member of the audience." Well, so the excitement was almost electric as Claude withdrew this beautiful antique pocket watch from his coat. "I want you each to keep your eye on this antique watch. It's a very special watch. It's been in my family for six generations." So he began to swing the watch gently back and forth while quietly chanting, "Watch the watch, watch the watch, watch the watch." The crowd became mesmerized as the watch swayed back and forth, light gleaming off its polished surface. Hundreds of pairs of eyes followed the swaying watch until, suddenly, it slipped from the hypnotist's fingers and fell to the floor, breaking into 100 pieces. "Shit," said the hypnotist.
"Oh, jeez.
You know, it took 3 days to clean up the Senior Citizen, and Claude was never invited back to entertain."
Oh, my gosh. That's hilarious. Well, so much for that. Well, humor is great. All right, we're back, and the lines are open, and this is Prescriptions for Health, and the number is 888-874-4888. We're talking about how to manage chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathies, which are such a difficult problem in the mainstream, and saying that it's great that a study on acupuncture, a little pilot study was done that showed that it could be of value. And then we talked about how this should be allowed in the hospital, along with a lot of other therapies, because people who are in the hospital are the sickest, the ones we have the most difficult time with. They're the ones that are often dying from what they have. Don't you think everything should be tried? Why do we just limit ourselves to the mainstream approach, where we're looking at just medicines and surgeries and technologies? Why not throw in acupuncture and some Chinese medicine or some energy healing approaches? What's wrong with Reiki therapy? Vicki, you do Reiki. How effective can that be?
Well, I did it on that patient in the hospital behind the closed door, and his wife was sending me gifts for months afterwards because he was in excruciating pain, and it really took away his pain, and those were in the days before we had a photon stimulator.
Exactly. And, you know, as we talk about chemotherapy-induced neuropathies or any other kind of neuropathy, or for that matter, any kind of pain, the infrared light therapy, the photon stimulator, which puts out near-infrared light at about 860 to 880 nanometers, is an incredible new technology that should be in every doctor's office, because every doctor sees somebody who has pain. Almost everybody has some pain.
How much percentage would you say of your office time do you spend using the photon stimulator?
Oh, maybe half, because who comes in that doesn't have a headache or a backache or something wrong with their foot, or they've had a sports injury or a carpal tunnel
or a neuropathy.
Peripheral neuropathy. Yeah, all those things. Or even a stroke. You know, there's some wonderful work being done now using this light on people who've had strokes.
Because it works on the nerves, I guess. Huh?
Well, the stroke, you know, is an area of the brain that's died, but the area around it, the peri-infarction area, is still vulnerable to limited blood supply, and it doesn't work that well. But if you put the light on that area, and it releases nitric oxide, and it dilates up those arteries, and all of a sudden you've got more blood flow, and also it increases the amount of ATP that they have, because the light is actually converted by the mitochondria into chemical energy called ATP, which is the same thing as gasoline is to a car. ATP is to a cell. Now, this is a stunning thing. And for people who have chemotherapy-induced neuropathies, I did a little pilot study myself with about 12 patients now who had chemotherapy-induced neuropathy, and found that about 75% of them really improved dramatically. They got rid of their pain, their numbness improved, they felt like their balance was better. So we're really looking at something that's an amazing technology for peripheral neuropathies. Now, why can't we use those off-label in the hospital? Why don't all the clinics with diabetes use the photon stimulator? Why don't they use it in the wound center to help make these wounds heal sooner, because we know it works? You can't get the time of day for a lot of these people.
Is it competition for what they're doing because maybe they're afraid of losing business or they're afraid of...
Some of it's that. Some of it's just is naive arrogance. They think they know everything. And it's interesting. I see we have a call from George from Long Island and wants to know something about diabetic neuropathy. Is there a cure for it? So, George, are you there?
Yes, sir. You answered half of the question. The other half is where can I go to get this neuropathy treated?
Yeah, see, that's a problem. There are people who have the infrared light, near-infrared light, and you could treat this, I think, without an imager, so anybody who has this would be good. There's a woman in Pittsburgh, that's the closest I know of, whose name is Connie Haber. She's a chiropractor, H-A-B-E-R. And if you look her up on Google, you'll find her address, and you could give her a call. She might be inclined to refer you to somebody in the city, in New York City. Otherwise, if you have diabetic neuropathy, you want to go see her or fly out and see me. You know, it's worth it.
Some people do that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, do you have pain with this, George?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, see, the pain very often, in my experience, okay, the FDA won't let me make statements that say this is a fact. So I say, in my experience, about 90% of people who have pain from diabetes, it's relieved in just a couple of days. And if you do it for about a week, which is what we did in our clinical trial out at the VA hospital in Martinez, California, we found that the numbness improved substantially. The proprioception, meaning how you walk, was improved substantially. And the pain was helped, even though we had some problems with that. So I would say that if you've got diabetic neuropathy, you're the perfect candidate for infrared light therapy. And my guess is you'll be able to come off your drugs. If you have any ulcers on your feet, there's a good chance, in my opinion, that we can heal them. I think it prevents a lot of the ulcers, and it prevents a lot of the amputations that often occur, and it's certainly wonderful for the pain. So
if you want
more information about this,
you can go to drsaputo.com.
We have a lot of information on our website, and it's D-O-C-T-O-R, Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O.com. And put in infrared light therapy in the search box, you'll get probably 50 articles that are on infrared light therapy that are all in audio and video. They're all short little bites that tell you about it. And you'll get great information. If you have any questions past that point, there's a way to get in touch with me, and it's just really Dr. Len, D-R-L-E-N, at drsaputo.com, and I'd be happy to answer any more questions you have, George.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Okay,
good luck with that.
Yeah, good luck. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. I just get so frustrated with hospitals, and I get really frustrated with a lot of doctors, too, who know their field well, and I have great respect for that, but I have a lot of contempt for their limited willingness to learn new technologies that don't hurt anybody. I mean, this infrared light wouldn't hurt a fly. Unless you're a moron, you know, and use it in a way that's just insane. But it's really easy to do. The problem is it's hard to find a doctor who has the infrared scanner, which is a way of, in real time, having a thermogram of what you're doing as you treat. So what you do is you take a picture of the thermogram, which is a heat pattern on the surface of the skin, that's in color, that gives the operator an opportunity to see what those patterns look like, make a diagnosis based on that, and then do treatment in real time in a frame that's next to it. So you can have a split screen, and you can see all these changes occurring. And for the problems that people have with cervical or lumbar discs, or for sports injuries or carpal tunnels or whatever the other kind of pain you have, that's a brilliant way to go. So I think we've come a long way in the last decade in bringing this forward. And I didn't mention, but I did. We're doing a clinical trial at UCSF starting in January that's NIH sponsored for $6 million to look at chemotherapy-induced neuropathies being treated with infrared light. Well, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. We'll be back taking your calls after a short station break.
Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number, if you have a question about your health or what we're talking about and would like to join in the conversation, give us a call at 888-874-4888.
Well, here's a global study of 100,000 nurses showing 20 to 60% are dissatisfied and burned out. You know, this isn't very encouraging for people that want to get into the nursing profession, is it?
No. I mean, why are they burning out is the question. And I think a lot of the time what we're looking at is that there are too many patients, there's too much stress.
And now they've lengthened a lot of the shifts.
Well, there's nothing like working more than you want to. I can remember all that when I was an intern and resident at a county hospital and being up for 36 hours and off for 12 for weeks and months at a time.
And I remember working 8 hours and being exhausted and not, you know, toward the end of the shift, all I could think about was how I wanted to go home and take a nap. And then I'd have my kids to deal with, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty soon they learned that mommy needed a nap.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's... We have to take care of the people that are taking care of patients, because if they're not well, we know that patient care suffers from it.
We don't have enough staff for all the patients that we have. You know, patients
No.
deserve to have more quality care. And I think most of the time the nurses are doing the best job they can. But,
yeah.
you know, if you don't have enough help, it's tough.
Well,
and this was more countries than just the U.S. This was Canada also, and Germany and the U.K. and New Zealand and Japan and Thailand, right. South Korea, and China.
Yeah, that's right. So what we're looking at is a widespread problem. And, you know, when we're looking at an economy like we have today, where things are tight and people are out of work and it's hard to afford some of the services that we'd like to provide, this is what happens. But, you know, it doesn't happen everywhere. When I was in the hospital, I got fantastic care.
Yeah, well, you were kind of a VIP, too, you know.
Well, maybe, but all I could do is report what happened. There were people coming by asking me how I was doing, was I satisfied with the care, and were the nurses doing what they should, and I was a happy camper from that point of view. So, you can find it, and I think that some hospitals really do provide that kind of care, and that's wonderful when we do, but when you don't, about half of the RNs feel that patients can't manage their care after the discharge because they just haven't had enough attention. And think of how you'd feel if you were in the hospital and you couldn't take care of something, like you had to have a bowel movement or you had a lot of pain and you want your pain medicine right now. And the nurses
or
got
a bedpan.
So many, yeah, or a bedpan. I mean, how are you going to feel when the nurse says, well, I'm going to be 10 minutes or 15 minutes, or doesn't say anything, and you're just sitting there pushing on the nurse's call button? That's a terrible thing to have happen, and it's maybe one of the reasons why it's a good idea to have an advocate in the hospital with you. I mean, when I was there, I had the great luxury of having Nurse Vicki, who's an RN that's worked ICU and CCU and IV teams and all those different places in the hospital. Man, anything went wrong in there, she was right on it. She checked my medicines. She made sure people washed their hands. You're great, Vicki. It's almost worth being sick just to have you.
I don't know about that.
And I don't either. But that's, you know, it's the truth. And how much better it feels when you've got somebody like that who you know is with you. And you can close your eyes and go to sleep and know that nothing's going to change that's bad because somebody's right there asking those questions, checking every medication that comes through to be sure it's the right one. Because there are a lot of mistakes that are made in the hospital when it comes to dispensing medications.
Well, the other thing, in reference to burnout, is that I think sometimes healthcare workers kind of take on some of the energy of sick people.
Yeah, for
sure. Particularly in areas like oncology,
mm-hmm.
That can get to be pretty depressing. And yeah. I don't know what they do now, but I know years ago they started giving the nurses an extra week off so that they could recuperate if they were suffering from burnout.
Well, that's right.
And I think it's a really good idea because in order to take care of somebody well, you need to be feeling well yourself. It can get like that in the units also, in the intensive care units, because the patients in there are pretty sick, you know?
Yeah, well, it's intense, and you have to really give the nurses credit. They are the caretakers. Doctors rarely are the caretakers. They're the thinkers. they put together programs of what kinds of treatments would be the most effective considering the situation. And God bless them for that. I mean, we need to have that. There'd be no point having a nurse if the patient was going to die because the treatment program wasn't right. But basically, it's the nurses who are there with the patients and listening and caring and supporting. And that's as important as the other part.
I think we could branch out here a little bit to talk about caretakers, because people that are, you know, spouses or children or what have you that are taking care of a loved one, or maybe a parent that's taking care of a child that's very ill. These people need a break once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
And they need attention themselves.
Right.
And they get burnout. And I think a lot of people just kind of ignore them.
No, for sure.
And I think it's good to come in.
Compliment them. Bring them some flowers. You know, thank them, you know, for all the wonderful work they're doing. Let them know how much you appreciate that they're there.
Or maybe offer to go in and sit with this sick person while they go and do an errand or something.
Sure.
Because they really do need some attention.
Well, I think doctors get that way, too. A lot of doctors are burning out now that we have HMO medicine. It's less personal. They're less connected in general. And it doesn't mean that it's all like that, because it's not. I mean, there's some doctors that are just sensational when it comes to that sort of thing. But most of the HMOs don't really want doctors spending a lot of time with their patients, because time is money. And what they're interested in, of course, is making money. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Hey, I want to quote the Donald. That's Donald Trump.
Oh, jeez.
On what he calls Dumbo Care.
Oh, my God.
And then we're going to comment on it. So this is from Donald Trump. He says, let me get this straight. We're going to be gifted with a health care plan we're forced to purchase and find if we don't, which purportedly covers at least 10 million more people without adding a single new doctor, but provides for 16,000 new IRS agents, written by a committee whose chairman says he doesn't understand it, passed by a Congress that didn't read it, but exempted themselves from it, and signed by a, he says, Dumbo president, who smokes. I guess he says that because, you know, that's not healthy. With funding administered by a Treasury chief who didn't pay his taxes, for which will be taxed for 4 years before any benefits take effect, by a government which has already bankrupted Social Security and Medicare, all to be overseen by a Surgeon General who is obese and financed by a country that's broke. What the heck could possibly go wrong?
Well, see, Donald Trump is an opportunist. Some of what he says is accurate to a point. It's overstated in general. I think Donald Trump is a disgrace. And it's not because I think that what he said here doesn't have something of a point.
Yeah, a lot of it makes sense.
But let's get real. We're talking about trying to cover 10 million more people. And he's criticizing that because we don't have any more doctors maybe to cover some of those services. But hey, those 10 million people didn't have health care before. Now it may be harder to get a doctor, but it may not either, because there are a lot of doctors. So that's one thing.
Of course, we were just talking about burnout, though.
Yeah, well, that's right.
There's not enough help.
Well, yeah, but you know, you do things in increments. You don't just all of a sudden have everybody getting health care like they deserve. That's why universal health care should have been something that we did. I didn't see Donald Trump supporting that. He's out there trying to pick holes in things, and he's got this crappy grin on his face that makes you think that he's some real smart guy. He's an opportunist. And the other thing is, he's talking about 16,000 new IRS agents. Well, why? I mean, we ought to look into that. And on the surface, it sounds like we got 16,000 new IRS agents. Wouldn't it be better to have 16,000 new doctors? But who's going to keep track of all this stuff? You may need 16,000 new IRS agents when you're talking about 10 million more people. You've got to be able to keep track of things. So I don't think Donald Trump is my cup of tea, that's for sure. And then the thing that I do agree with him is that how in the world did the Affordable Health Care Act get written? Who wrote the damn thing? Why is it thousands of pages long? And why don't we all go through it step by step rather than saying, well, here, Congress, have it. Now you have 48 hours to read this and digest it.
And they were having to hire attorneys to help them understand the lingo.
Now, that's outrageous. And, of course, that tells you about the whole political system that needs to change. I mean, in a democracy, how could that even be remotely entertained? That's just horrible. Just horrible. And, of course, it tells you a lot about people are thinking for our Congress. Our Congress isn't making the big decisions. It's the people who support them economically. So you've got the corporations of America owning by bribing, by giving funds, okay, to Congress people. And, of course, what do the Congress people want? The most important thing? To get reelected, not to provide you good service. So they take the money from these corporations, and then they have to pay them back. And what they do is they give them political favors. What kind of democracy is that? What happened to you and me? What happened to little guy? What happened to we the people? I mean, come on. So, Donald, you got a point there, but, I didn't need you to tell me that. And I don't like your attitude about how you come down on all these things because you're, in my opinion, just an opportunist. Okay. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. Well, we have a call. I didn't see that. Of a Mike from Michigan who wants to talk about the health effects of smart meters. Mike, you there?
Yes. Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. They're trying to put all these in Michigan now, and and they said it's like having 100 cell phones on at once, and it pulses 6,000 times a day, and the radiation comes right into your house.
Yeah, well, that's right. Some of that's true. I don't know the details on the numbers that you just said, but it wouldn't surprise me that you're exactly right.
Yes.
I think that it's morally wrong that companies like the energy producers can do something before we know that it's safe and impose it on us. I mean, that to me is just outrageous.
Yes.
And again, it shows you the power that corporations have over what we do.
Yes.
And how much do we actually know about energy medicine? In the mainstream, nada. We don't do energy medicine for the most part. But you look at complementary and alternative medicine, there are a lot of fields where they're looking at things like this. And we got enough trouble with cell phones, Mike.
Exactly.
Here we got something that's way stronger than that, and they're just putting it in, and we just have to lump it. You got a good point.
Yes. Well, you can post on your meter that you do not want it, and then they can't do it.
Well, that's good. People should know that.
Yes.
Thanks for calling us and letting us know, Mike.
Thank you for your time.
You have a great day. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So here's an article that's talking about how young women may reduce their heart disease risk by eating fish with omega-3 fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
But, how often do young women really have heart problems? And we've read articles in the past about how it's really dangerous for women of, because basically what they're talking about in this article are women of childbearing age.
Yeah, really.
That this is really dangerous for them to be eating mercury.
Yeah, well, a lot of fish are laden with mercury because we polluted our oceans now.
And that it's not good for their babies either. So maybe
the
fish would be healthy for them if they didn't have the mercury, but they didn't do that study.
No, well, they were kind of opportunistic here. And what they looked at was percentages. They say women not eating fish had 50% more heart attacks and strokes over 8 years than those eating any type of fish. And those not eating fish at all had a 90% more a risk for a heart attack or a stroke than those who are eating omega-3 rich fish like cod, salmon, herring, and mackerel. So, yeah, that's true, but those numbers are very misleading because how many people, under the age of 50, they were talking about people 15 to 50, are going to have a heart attack, if you're a woman. It's just not going to be much. But it's still something to consider, and we should be getting our essential fatty acids because essential fatty acids are something that we cannot make. That's why they're called essential fatty acids. The body cannot make them.
But the body needs them.
If the body doesn't get them, we die. 95% of Americans are deficient in essential fatty acids, according to three studies done by the USDA on tens of thousands of people. So we know there's a widespread deficiency amongst Americans.
So let's go over those fish again, then, if it's this important. It's cod, salmon, herring, and mackerel.
Exactly.
But, you know, salmon needs to be the wild salmon, not the farm salmon. Those are so polluted.
Well,
no matter what
they
try to tell you.
They don't feed them essential fatty acids either. I mean, those fish eat krill or other things that have essential fatty acids.
Not the ones that are farmed, Fred.
No, I wouldn't buy a farmed fish.
And a lot of times you can even go into a health food store and they'll try to tell you how their farms are so healthy.
I know.
But you really don't want to eat fish unless it's wild salmon, cod, herring, or mackerel.
All right,
or you might want to think about, now this study wasn't on fish oil supplements, but some of the fish oil supplements are purified and they do take the mercury out of them.
Yeah, well, that's good. And that's, I think, what I would recommend be done. When you look at studies on, this was 20 years ago, on little Japanese babies and on little American babies, the little Japanese babies had a higher IQ. Why?
Mothers ate more fish?
No. Well, they did. That probably is true. But they were replacing the nutrients in a bottle, okay, that has milk from the store with essential fatty acids in Japan, and they weren't doing that here. And so as a consequence, because we need the DHA and the EPA that's in the fish oil for the baby's brain to develop normally, they develop more, much better than those in this country. Today, now, finally, we know how important they are. So in baby's formula, they're adding these essential fatty acids. I tell people that are pregnant not to consume fish at all, because the mercury that's in the fish is going to be concentrated by the placenta, so that there's 15 times more mercury in the baby's body than there is in the mother's body, because the breast is but that's what happens. So we have to be sure that we're limiting the amount of mercury that we take in, and fish are definitely a risk, and there's no reason why we can't be doing other things like eating flaxseed oil, which doesn't have a mercury problem at all, or doing other seeds and nuts that are rich in those products.
Well, the other thing is too, you know, women that are pregnant that are under a doctor's care are taking prenatal vitamins.
Right.
So why not just add the flaxseed oil or fish oil?
Yeah, sure.
That's purified without the mercury to those prenatal vitamins, because it sounds like it's a really healthy thing for them to have the omega-3s. And then, like you said, eating seeds and nuts and so
right.
forth.
And the omega-6s are important, too, but they need to be healthy omega-6s. You can't get them. You know, they're in the oils, the vegetable oils that we process to get the omega-6s that we need. But the way that they're processed ruins the oils, so that when you go to your regular grocery store, you're getting polluted oils. You need to probably get it from food. You know, eat the vegetables themselves, eat the seeds and nuts. You know, or take some evening primrose or black currant or borage oils, which have the wonderful omega-6s that are in that the body needs. In a capsule.
And a good little tip to know is that if you are taking oil in a capsule, it's a good idea to cut open the top of it and then just kind of taste it, because you can tell
yeah.
if something's rancid or not. It
yeah.
has a particular
It'll sour your tongue. You go, oh, this stuff is terrible. And the good stuff tends to be lighter in color.
Yes.
Okay, lighter in color. And it doesn't taste bad at all. It doesn't have that bitter bite that you get with a rancid oil. So that's a good point, Vicki. All right, so the lines are open. The number is 888-874-4888.
Last week we talked about how many doctors and nurses, and we did today too, don't wash their hands when they're entering or leaving patients' rooms. And now here's a study out of Canada reporting that C. difficile, which is the most common cause of infectious diarrhea in hospitals, increases the length of hospital stays on average of 6 days, plus 10% of the patients die. So I guess this could mean that you could die from it in 6 days.
Well, no, it doesn't mean that. That's an average.
Well, if the average stay is 6 days and 10% die,
well,
I mean, what else do you think could be done to prevent this besides hand washing anyway?
A lot. I mean, we're treating most people in the hospital with antibiotics. what better way is there to kill the normal bacteria that live in the gut that are your friends, because they're crowding out the bad guys and doing a lot of good things for you that you need them for? I mean, I would be sure that I would supply probiotics to people.
So in other words, what they're doing is they're making a fertile ground for this C. difficile to grow in.
When you wipe out the normal microbes that are sensitive to the antibiotic, and particularly if you take them by mouth, it's going to kill all the bugs that the antibiotic is able to kill. And the ones that are left are what? The ones that are resistant to the antibiotic. Now, that's kind of a dumb thing to do to the gut, isn't it? You're selecting out all the bad guys and saying, hey, here's more land for you to grow on. And go ahead and reproduce, because we're going to give you more turf and more nutrients.
I think it sounds like when people are admitted to the hospital because of the possibility of acquiring some of these superbugs,
right,
they should probably all be put automatically on probiotics, because most people that are in the hospital are on an antibiotic. And also,
right,
you could maybe talk a little bit about Saccharomyces boulardii and what that is and why.
Well, that's a friendly yeast that's different than Candida, and it doesn't hurt you. So if you take a little Saccharomyces when you're in the hospital as well, it'll keep the Candida from overcrowding. And what it will do is take up that turf itself. And most antibiotics don't affect the Saccharomyces, because it's a yeast as well.
Yeah, because I think what you're saying is that most antibiotics can have a side effect of getting a yeast infection.
Well, that too. It wipes out all the flora, and then whatever
so this
can
would
grow
help,
back will.
So this Saccharomyces boulardii would help to prevent you from getting the thrush and Candida?
Yeah, because it crowds out all the other
from
yeast.
From the antibiotic.
Okay, the Candida, that's the problem. So C. difficile is a serious infection. It's preventable. And using a probiotic is the first step. Saccharomyces would be maybe a second step. Using a little bit of L-glutamine, which is an amino acid that's a major fuel of the small intestine, would be a real smart move, because after about 3 days, your gut is basically involuting, because it needs to have nutrients to keep it functioning.
Another thing that I've noticed is that a lot of the gastroenterologists order antibiotics for C. difficile.
Oh, I know. I know.
They're to giving, try to kill it.
Well, I know. And that's the logic of the mainstream doctors, is if there's an infection there, do what you can to kill it. And a lot of the times it doesn't work. I know I had 5 or 6 patients when I was doing hospital work, because I had mentioned that I knew how to fix C. difficile enterocolitis, and they said, oh, yeah, sure. But after they had a few patients in there for a few weeks and they were doing all the things they were doing and still sick, they thought they'd show me, you know, that they were right and I was wrong. They said, okay, Mr. Smart Guy, why don't you come in and do your stuff now? Here's a consultation for you. Well, all 6 of them were out of the hospital within a week.
And what was interesting was that those doctors never referred any other
patients.
Isn't that
the oddest thing? And today now they're starting to talk about probiotics more.
But one of the doctors sent his wife to come see you.
Well, yeah, they do that. When they have no other options, they'll do something if it's non-invasive, and that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, now, this article is saying that people can end up in the hospital for 6 extra days.
Well, the average is that.
But some people are sent home with it.
Well, I think that's okay. I don't see any reason to over-treat C. difficile. And that rubs a lot of gastroenterologists
except for you could die from it.
Well, yeah, but, you know, C. difficile is there anyway. It's now in the normal flora of outpatients, and they aren't sick from it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you get sick from it is because it's allowed to overgrow when you do something to give it a growth advantage, like take an antibiotic, because the antibiotic doesn't affect C. difficile.
Oh, see, and that's just so
okay.
Amazing.
Plus,
because then they give them more antibiotics to cure it.
Yeah, or if your immunity isn't that good, you'll allow the C. difficile to grow more too. So this is common sense, but you know, it takes time for medical strategies to change, to evolve into better places. And we're not doing the best job of encouraging our gastroenterologists to learn these things. There are very few bowel conditions that you can't help a lot with a protocol like this. And there's a book called Optimal Digestive Health that was written by a gastroenterologist whose name is Trent Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, that I wrote 4 or 5 of the chapters in, that I would suggest you learn about. There's also a lot of information about IBS and ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease on our website at drsaputo.com.
And also in the book Boosting Immunity.
Yeah. And so these are, I mean, I'd go to the website because there you can get the direct information. It's all in audio and video, and it's easy to evaluate. And the site is free. It doesn't cost a penny. You have to join it to be able to take surveys, but it's free to join. And then you could take the IBS survey, you know, the irritable bowel syndrome survey, and then get specific audios and videos that will tell you about what's going on, okay, with your health in this particular area. So when you take the questionnaire, which takes maybe 2 minutes at the most, you're answering yes or no, or it's multiple choice, or it's some checkoff thing, you'll get audios and videos that are specific to your situation, depending on how you answered questions. So, and we do that for 20 health conditions. So there are cholesterol and diabetes and hypertension and heart disease. These are all things that are readily available on the site that are fantastic and free. So go to drsaputo.com and you'll get some of this stuff. Well, at the end of the show, I'd like to remind you that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on prn.fm and drsaputo.com from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived on drsaputo.com as well as prn.fm.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
And have a wonderful week. We'll see you next week.